This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a brain surgeon, my guest Katrina Furlick describes herself as part scientist, part mechanic. She writes, "Many of the brains I encounter have been pushed around by tumors, blood clots, infections, or strokes that have swollen out of control. Some have been invaded by bullets, nails, or even maggots. I see brains at their most vulnerable." Dr. Furlick has written a new memoir about her work called Another Day in the Frontal Lobe. She was the first woman admitted to the neurosurgery residency program at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. She now has a private practice and is a clinical assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine. And a heads up to listeners who get a little queasy hearing about medical procedures, our conversation about her work sometimes gets a little graphic. When I read the story in your book about the patient with a nail lodged 2 inches into his brain, I thought, you have to tell this story on Fresh Air. So let's start at the beginning. So this guy comes into the emergency room. What do you see?
Well, I see basically a normal appearing carpenter wearing his construction boots, sitting up on the hospital gurney in the emergency room. And he pretty much looks like a normal guy. Arms crossed, waiting for me there in the ER. And he looks normal. That's the first thing I see.
Except for the nail sticking out of his head.
Well, that you can't see at first glance. And the interesting thing is, this was put in his head accidentally by his friend because they were putting up a siding of a house. And so this was an automatic nail gun, pretty high power nail gun. And it basically lodged itself through the skull into the left frontal lobe with pretty good force, such that all you could see, if you got up close to him, was the flat silver head of the nail, kind of flush with the scalp. So you couldn't see the nail just looking at him head on. You really had to get close to him.
Wow. Okay. So, obviously you can't just like pull it out of his head.
Exactly. The first thing I had to do was to examine him, do a very brief neurological examination. I could see, obviously, that he was awake and talking and acting normally. Did a brief examination of his pupils, shine a light in his eyes and check his strength in all of his limbs and check reflexes, that sort of standard examination. But the next step, the more critical step, actually, was getting the CAT scan to see what the snail had done, where it had gone, and whether or not it caused any bleeding.
So what did you find? What did you find with the CAT scan?
Basically, luckily, he was lucky enough that the nail went in, but really didn't seem to have done any damage to the surrounding brain. In other words, it didn't snag any blood vessels on the way in, didn't snag any veins or arteries, and it looked like it was just sitting there.
It's just amazing. And he got through the test that you gave him okay? He didn't seem to be
impaired?
Exactly.
How is that possible? Well, first of all, the thing I have to say is that the examination that we do in the emergency room is about a 5-minute or less examination. We're trying to work through things quickly. And so I didn't test any sort of very esoteric frontal lobe functions, in terms of higher level thinking and decision making and the things that the frontal lobes really mediate. And so I kind of expected him to be normal. And the frontal lobes, they're very forgiving. So you can actually do a lot more damage to the frontal lobe and still be pretty much the same person who you've always been.
Okay, so let's get back to this nail that's hammered into his head.
Yes.
What did you do to get it out?
Well, first I called the appropriate team, had to call anesthesia and call the supervising neurosurgeon. At the time, I was a resident, which means that I was in training in my neurosurgery residency program, and took him to the OR, and we basically shaved a small patch of hair, made an incision in the scalp, and then we took a drill and drilled a circle around the nail. So the nail was actually at the center of the circle. And after having done that, we gently, carefully lifted that disc of skull up with the nail in it. And we're very lucky to find that there was no bleeding coming forth from the hole that it had created in the surface of the brain. And a common slogan among surgeons is better lucky than good. And at that point, we were feeling pretty lucky.
Okay, so you get the piece of skull out with the nail hammered into it. And then how do you get the nail out of the skull?
Well, this particular nail had a couple of barbs, kind of copper color barbs that were sticking out at various angles. And so we had to take those barbs out. And then we used whatever hammering device we could find to hammer the nail back out of that skull backwards, and left with a nice neat little hole in the center of the disc of bone, cleaned everything up with an antibiotic solution, and put it back.
How?
Well, we use these small titanium, very thin, slick little titanium plates that we screw in. And these are very small. We're talking, you know, a couple millimeters thick that we use to plate the piece of bone back in. And so when we're done, pretty much, you know, can't see that we had taken this bone out in the first place once we close the scalp back up. You're not left with any sort of divot or hole in the head. In other words, it's cosmetically a nice result.
How did he come out of it?
He came out fine. This was, you know, luckily the nail did not do any damage on the way in, and even more lucky, did not do any damage on the way out. And watched him in the hospital overnight. The next morning, we got another scan just to make sure that there was nothing we had missed in terms of any other bleeding or bruising of the brain. That looked great. He was up walking around, eating breakfast, and begging us to leave.
Now, you point out in your book that being a neurosurgeon means that part of you is always thinking about larger things like consciousness.
Yes.
And part
yes,
of you is just
exactly.
a mechanic. So
exactly.
In terms of the mechanical part of brain surgery, is brain surgery more delicate and more risky than most other surgeries? You know the expression, it's not brain surgery. Well, what you do
sure.
is brain surgery.
Sure. It depends on, you know, there's a huge range of different types of brain operations. Some of them are very coarse and simplistic in terms of, say, taking a blood clot out of the brain. There's not that much to it, technically. You make a hole in the skull and you find the blood clot and you, for lack of a better word, suck the blood clot out. It sounds kind of crude, but it's mechanistically fairly straightforward. But then there are other types that are incredibly delicate. We're working around very difficult structures, say at the base of the brain, the nerves and the brainstem and that sort of thing. And that's where we bring the microscope in, and it may take several hours, and that's on the other extreme. So brain surgery really spans a huge spectrum of different types of cases.
Can you tell us about a surgery that you performed where you felt like the surgery enabled you to almost like help with a miracle of bringing somebody back or saving
sure.
saving the neurological
sure.
function when it seemed like that would be impossible?
Yes, that happens actually, luckily, more and more these days. There's a diagnosis called NPH, or normal pressure hydrocephalus. It's one of the few reversible forms of dementia. So obviously the most common form of dementia is Alzheimer's. NPH is one in which you can actually reverse the dementia that's taken place. And it's done with a fairly straightforward procedure. It takes about an hour to perform in the operating room. But you can take a person who, for example, one of my patients recently had been in a nursing home for months, wheelchair bound, in a diaper, couldn't really read anything, was apathetic. Turns out a very shrewd neurologist, very, very smart neurologist realized, you know what, I think this guy may have had NPH or may have NPH in the late stages. Did the appropriate testing. Turns out that he did. I put a shunt in him, and within, and a shunt, I should back up. A shunt is a device that takes off extra spinal fluid in the brain and that diverts it into the abdomen. So basically the underlying problem here is that there's too much fluid in the brain. And the shunt enables us to treat the disorder. But fast forward a few months, and he is now back at home, reading the New York Times, walking, and had regained his driver's license. So you take a person who, you know, everyone thinks is basically in a nursing home for life, and you reverse it, and you make him a fully functional individual. And that's just miraculous. Not so much because of me putting the shunt in, but more for the neurologist and figuring out that that's the diagnosis. The shunt is the easy part. It's more making the correct diagnosis in the person. And luckily, there's more awareness about this diagnosis these days, so more and more people are being treated.
My guest is Dr. Katrina Furlick. She writes about her work as a neurosurgeon in her new memoir, Another Day in the Frontal Lobe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Katrina Furlick. She's a neurosurgeon, and her new memoir is called Another Day in the Frontal Lobe. Now, you tell a story about something you learned the hard way, which is that if somebody has, you know, a head wound or a gunshot wound, even if they're going to die pretty soon as a result of that wound, you still have to stitch the wound up. Tell us your story.
Well, it's a bit disturbing, but it was a valuable lesson for me. And, you know, we saw the whole gamut of brain trauma. You know, the most common would be, say, car accidents. But on occasion, we would get patients who were either the subject of a homicide or a suicide attempt, and we'd have to figure out how aggressive to be. Now, luckily, when it comes to gunshot wounds, we kind of think of a dumbbell approach, in that some people come in and they're clearly going to live, or they're clearly not going to make it. And there's not a huge middle ground there. So the decision-making in the beginning when they hit the ER is fairly straightforward. But I remember a case in particular where it was on the more pessimistic end of that dumbbell. He was a man who had tried to commit suicide and had come in to the ER still breathing and still with some very rudimentary neurological function. But at that point, we realized there's really nothing we can do for him. So in my interest to really treat the family more so than treating the patient, I really just helped the nurse clean everything up. I, you know, took some nice sterile white gauze and wrapped his head as best as I could, and just really wanted them to be able to come into the room knowing that he probably wouldn't make it for even more than a few hours. So got everything ready for him. I went home that evening, you know, knowing that in the morning he would no longer be there. Now, it turns out in the morning, I was horrified to find out that he was still alive and was still breathing away normally, and his family had been there all night holding vigil at the bedside. I felt absolutely terrible for the family that they had been through this torture. And I talked to my attending, or my supervising neurosurgeon on the phone. I gave him the update, because this was about 6 a.m., and I said, you know, it turns out this guy is still alive. What what do I do here? This is unexpected. He said, well, you sutured up the bullet holes, right? There are two holes, you know, the exit wound and the entry wound. And I said, well, no. I mean, he was going to expire within hours. I didn't do anything. I just wrapped his head. He said, well, you know, you should have known better. You have to suture up the holes here, because what happens is, in a serious injury like this, the brain swells. When it swells, it will exit through the path of least resistance, which are those pre-existing holes. And that, in a sense, decompresses the brain and decompresses the skull, so that what would otherwise be a rapid death is then prolonged, because the pressure inside the head is released. So I had to basically have the family leave the room, finish the job that I should have done in the emergency room, and he then promptly expired a few hours after that. But it was one of those lessons that really struck me. And in the end, it wasn't so much that I was worried about the patient, of course, because I wasn't treating the patient, but I felt I had failed the family in not treating the situation appropriately.
It must be emotionally difficult to treat a patient who clearly was committed to killing themselves. I mean, when you shoot yourself in the head with a gun, you're pretty serious about killing yourself. It's not a cry for help like taking pills might be.
Right. And I have to say, it's in some ways even worse, you know, than this scenario that I just described. Even worse when somebody does make it. And you always, it's a catch-22. You're doing everything you can to save their life, and in the end, they come out not only neurologically impaired, but alive, and they don't. That's exactly what they didn't want. So it's a real catch-22. It's in some ways an ethical dilemma. But when they hit the ER, the spur of the moment, you really have to do whatever you have to do without necessarily thinking of the ethical consequences at the end.
Now, are you often in, or at least consulted on, difficult decisions about when or if to pull the plug on somebody who's been diagnosed as being brain dead?
Yes, that is part of our role, and it happens, you know, fairly frequently in a big academic center, for example, where I did my training, where we saw a lot of severe head injuries, a lot of severe cases of bleeding into the brain, and it's a very tricky decision to make. Frequently, the surgeon will have a very strong view one way or the other, And it's just a question of making sure that the family is all on the same page. But there are certain cases where it's a no-brainer, so to speak, where it's just there's really nothing that can be done. And you don't want to prolong a life only because there's no chance of neurological recovery. And those sort of cases are fairly easy decisions. But then there are other ones that are more on the fence that take some back and forth, especially when you're dealing with, say, a younger person. It gets trickier.
What did the Terry Schiavo case make you think about, as a neurosurgeon?
Mm-hmm. Well, I watched that case very closely. I was very, very interested in that case, as you might expect. And I guess I was a bit disappointed in the fact that I was on the side of letting her peacefully pass away, only having seen patients like that myself, knowing the torture that can ensue when you prolong things. The other thing is that when patients are in that state, they do have some primitive neurological reflexes left, and those are easily mistaken for conscious interaction. So, for example, I was horrified to find out that people thought that they were actually interacting with her visually, that she would follow them across the room. And then it turns out on autopsy, her entire visual cortex, which controls vision, was non-existent based on her injuries. So all those years, family thinking that she was following them and tracking them was completely impossible. So it's that sort of thing where you see subtle neurological function and you misinterpret it that really gets kind of complicated.
Now, you studied at the University of Pittsburgh, where you were the first woman neurosurgeon.
Yes.
And University of Pittsburgh apparently has the biggest neurosurgery department in the country.
It does.
So why do you think there are so few neurosurgeons, women neurosurgeons?
Well, I think, a couple things. One is that there's just a reputation for the training program being very harsh, very male-dominated. And that's just kind of the prevailing, culture. However, I have to say that there weren't serious, egregious incidences where I felt like I was being discriminated against or, where I thought sexism was at play. And I think it's slowly coming around that there's no problem with women entering the field. And there are more and more residents who are women in the training program. So even though only about 5% of practicing neurosurgeons out in the community are women, there are a greater number of people going through the training program who are women. So that's slowly changing.
When patients see that you're a woman, I guess you have a private practice, so a lot of patients come to you knowing who you are. They've chosen you. But back when you were working in the emergency room, when a patient saw you and saw that you were a woman, would they try to find a way to tell somebody else in charge, I don't want her?
Well, it's funny because actually you might think that was more of a problem. It's actually, I guess not a problem, but more of a challenge actually being out in practice as opposed to being a resident. As a resident, the patients know that you're not the end of the line. You're not the boss. Whereas out in practice, I am the boss. There's no one ahead of me. There's no one superior to me who's making decisions, for example. So it's actually come more to the forefront in my private practice than it has during my training. And it's not an insurmountable problem by any means, but I think I tend to get certain questions that I know that male neurosurgeons don't get quite as often. So it's a little bit of a challenge when I first meet a patient, just to kind of get over that little hurdle. And it may take a few minutes to get them comfortable. But, just as an example, I may see a patient for the first time in the office. I may spend a good half hour, 45 minutes with them explaining the pros and the cons of a particular operation. I may go through an anatomical model and go through all the details and that sort of thing. And at the end of this long conversation where they've asked questions, I've answered them, they'll say, so who actually does the surgery? And I'm always amazed because I introduce myself as the neurosurgeon, but they still somehow don't get the picture that I'm the one doing all the things that I'm describing. So it's a kind of a funny funny impasse that we come to, and I have to kind of recalibrate. Okay, no, I'm the surgeon here. Everything we've been talking about is based on what I do. So I don't think that men get that quite as often, but I do find it funny.
Well, Dr. Furlick, thanks for telling us some really fascinating things about the brain and neurosurgery. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Katrina Furlick is the author of Another Day in the Frontal Lobe. She's a clinical assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.